Welcome to the podcast series, Who is Afraid of Migration? An information tool developed in the framework of the eMindful project, implemented by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, in partnership with the International Labour Organization and the European University Institute, with the financial support of the Directorate General Home Affairs and Migration of the European Commission, the German Foreign Office, the Italian Ministry of Labour, the Central European Initiative, and the Southeast Europe Cooperative Initiative. My name is Teresa Albano, Economic Affairs Officer at the Office of the Coordinator of Economic and Environmental Activities at the Vienna-based Secretariat of the OSCE. The title of this podcast series echoes the famous play by Edward Albee, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? In the play, a brilliant intellectual couple engages in an emotionally charged debate, including inventing a fake child as a way to evade the ugliness of their marriage. Similarly, the public debate on migration gets very often partial and polarized, with negatives exaggerated and positives overlooked, somehow lost in translation. Throughout this podcast series, we will discuss how migration can be communicated in an effective way, inviting a variety of inspirational guests to join the conversation. We are here today with Natalia Banulescu-Bogdan, the Associate Director of the International Program of the think tank Migration Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C.
Hello. Good morning. Glad to be here today.
So, Natalia, thank you for being with us. Your publications include the titles such as Understanding and Addressing Public Anxiety About Migration, and the most recent, From Fear to Solidarity, The Difficulty in Shifting Public Narratives About Refugees. You are therefore the right person to kick off a conversation about why people develop mixed emotions regarding migrants and why narratives should be handled carefully as they can exacerbate tensions. Indeed, migration seems to be an emotionally charged topic, one of those red buttons that can divide a neighborhood, decide elections, or influence interstate relations. Can you help us understand how people shape their views about migrants and why migration seems such an intractable subject?
Yes, migration can indeed be a very emotionally charged topic. But I do want to start by saying that despite concerns about growing polarization, most people aren't actually at the extremes of public opinion. I think most people actually occupy more of a middle ground and have what we can call ambivalence about migration. They can have empathy and believe that migrants make important contributions, while also sometimes feeling anxious about rapid change that feels too fast or unplanned. So I think instead of picturing people at opposite poles, we should instead think of people as holding multiple overlapping, sometimes competing views at once. And each of these stories can become more or less salient under different circumstances, or based on, you know, how issues are framed by politicians or in the media. And, you know, that said, of course, there are some people who have very strong beliefs about immigration. And in some cases, these beliefs turn into a sort of social identity. And when that happens, you know, once an issue becomes intertwined with how people define and understand their place in the world, that's when facts and evidence don't matter anymore. No single data point is going to be able to dislodge a belief that has become part of somebody's identity. People will simply dismiss or discount any evidence they encounter that contradicts what they already believe to be true. And, you know, most people won't even put themselves in situations where they're exposed to contradictory beliefs. We can so easily curate our information environments these days. And the other thing is, even if people do come into contact with new information, they will often rationalize it as an exception to the rule rather than allow it to change their worldview. So, you know, the difficulty is we assume that people are motivated by accuracy and therefore injecting evidence into these emotionally charged debates is going to be the thing that moves the needle, but actually accuracy is much less important than values and belonging.
True, I understand. Indeed, migration is one of those complex social topics that are difficult to approach without a good story. In our analysis of the dominant narrative frames, we identified three main stereotyped storylines: the victim, the hero, and the predator. The narrative about migrant victim is popular not because of its appeal to the listener, but rather to the storyteller. Migrants are something like distant poor relatives, targets for exercises of impersonal kindness. The hero narrative is not more effective, however. An overly positive standpoint on migration may not be the most persuasive strategy. The predator narrative is indeed gripping, and this is not surprising. Horror stories were always more popular than educational novels. Can you give us three basic tips to shape effective migration narratives?
Sure. My first tip is actually to move away from trying to change attitudes. And this might sound counterintuitive, but I think that trying to eradicate fear and anxiety about immigration is unrealistic and not a good investment. So I think instead we need to try to understand what makes these fears more or less prominent. How can we reduce the intensity or salience of anti-immigration sentiment? And my second recommendation is to stop singling out migrants, whether to draw attention to their needs or even to their contributions or accomplishments. I think this can counterintuitively reinforce divisions, especially when people already feel under threat in society. And so, you know, you mentioned three of the dominant frames that are often used to tell stories about migrants. And the common thread in each of these narratives you've described is that they set immigrants apart from the rest of society, whether because they're depicted as deserving extraordinary compassion, whether they've made exceptional contributions, or because they, you know, are seen as posing a distinct harm or threat. And I think the problem is that even the narratives designed to elicit support and compassion function the same way by creating this strong us versus them dichotomy. So even if you're doing it as a way to draw attention to the positives, the end result is still creating this distance. So my third tip is to try instead to tell a story of us, find the common ground, draw attention to the common goals between newcomers and natives. And when crafting policy, this means showing people that investing in integrating newcomers is something that benefits the whole community and furthers individual people's own goals and interests, not something that's done out of charity.
Yeah, sure. I fully agree. We have been talking so far about migrants, but we know that this overarching term encompasses also a special category of people who are forced to leave their countries due to persecution and conflict. Refugees seem to attract more empathy in the public discourse because of the pain and the suffering they go through. On the other hand, experience confirms that generally, after the initial wave of genuine solidarity, a certain level of fatigue emergence in hosting communities. What is the role of communication in diffusing anxieties before they become fears?
Great question. In many places in the world, I think it is true that there's generally more sympathy for people seen as fleeing persecution than for those seen as simply seeking better economic opportunities. But this is a bit of a Western view. And actually, if you look at Latin America, Asia, even Eastern Europe, you see a much more mixed picture. It's not actually always true that people prefer refugees. And we've also seen this insidious dividing line between those who are considered, you know, genuine refugees versus those seen as gaming the system, particularly asylum seekers at the border. So the bottom line is that even in places where there have been incredible surges in solidarity toward refugees, and we have seen this with displacement from Venezuela, from Syria, now with Ukraine, these feelings don't last forever, especially as crises become prolonged and hospitality fatigue sets in. So after the emergency phase of a crisis, you see practical concerns about the future begin to dominate, including whether immigrants or refugees are able to find jobs and become self-sufficient, whether refugees are integrating or seen as living parallel lives. And the important thing to understand is these concerns can become prominent even in places that have seen immense short-term solidarity on cultural or political grounds. So in other words, these feelings of brotherhood, pride, compassion that can be extraordinarily powerful also don't neutralize everyday sources of friction that all groups living side by side will eventually face. And this is especially true if host communities don't feel they're getting the right amount of support, again, especially as crises wear on and time goes on. And the issue is that once countries do reach what we've called in previous work, this tipping point where public opinion swings from generosity to resentment, it can happen very quickly. It can be very hard to turn the situation around. And so we talk a lot about strategies to address anxieties before they become existential, when you still have an opportunity to, you know, affect change. And one of the most important things is simply acknowledging people's practical concerns about the future, including things like whether low-skilled refugees will be able to become formally employed rather than undercutting wages or competing for jobs. And critically, I think governments need to demonstrate to publics from day one that they have a plan for long-term integration, not just short-term reception. You see this being particularly critical with the displacement from Ukraine right now. And this also means paying attention to the symbolism of certain investments and taking care to address the barriers to things like job creation or healthcare for entire communities rather than granting preference or being seen as granting preference to newcomers over others.
We face these challenges every day. And I fully agree with you. We should invest much more in resilience before anxieties turns into existential fears, as you said. So, Natalia, before we conclude and going back to the title of this podcast series, are there good reasons for being afraid about migration?
Honestly, I think it is part of the human condition to be anxious and wary about large-scale change. But what we see that has happened all over the world is that people have seized upon immigration as the face of these fears, something over which we can exercise control at times when things feel very out of control, especially when it comes to the effects of amorphous things like globalization or the pandemic. When there's no one on which to project our fears, immigrants often become the convenient scapegoats. But we do need to disentangle this type of scapegoating or xenophobia from normal, legitimate concerns about the day-to-day changes people are experiencing. So I would just end by saying there will always be both costs and benefits associated with immigration. And these costs and benefits fall unevenly on different parts of society. And I think sometimes we're uncomfortable talking about the costs and how they might disproportionately affect certain segments of the population. You know, low-wage workers who might be displaced by immigrants, for instance. But it's this glossing over people's legitimate fears and anxieties that's one of the things that really fuels panic and rejection of immigrants. And, you know, we've seen it put wind in the sails of anti-immigration voices and far-right and radical-right politicians.
Yeah, so embracing concerns rather than pushing them back and overlooking them. Yeah. So really, thank you so much, Natalia. I wish to renew my thanks for your participation. Really eye-opening. Thank you so much. We really enjoyed your insights on a topic that is too often oversimplified. I wish to extend my thanks to the public who listened to our podcast today. I hope we provided information, inspiration, engagement, entertainment. The contents of the podcast are the sole responsibility of its authors and guest speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the European Union, of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the International Labour Organization, and the European University Institute, their partners, donors, affiliates, and employees. The podcast series does not constitute an endorsement by any of these organizations of the opinions expressed therein. Neither the OSCE nor its affiliate, nor any of their respective donors, agents, employees, information providers, or content providers shall be liable to any user or anyone else for any inaccuracy, error, omission, interruption, deletion, defect, alteration, or use of any content herein. Bye-bye from the eMindful Project. Keep tuned on our website and share your inputs on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you.